Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello, welcome to episode number 127 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. First of all, like ever, thank you very much to our Patreon supporters. We could not create this podcast without you. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do it from as little as £3 a month. The quickest way to do it is to go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram page. And on their profile, you will see a Linktree drop-down box, which will direct you straight to the Patreon page. And if you're not able, that's fine, because this content is free for everyone. If you listened to last week's episode, you'd be aware that we have got a virtual exhibition coming up for all the 97%er artists. And if you're unaware, a 97%er is an artist that doesn't use their art practice as their sole income. So yeah, it's a virtual exhibition. It's £15 to enter, unless you're a badge holder, and then it's 12. And the best thing is, the artist gets 100% of the sale price. And all proceeds go back into supporting the podcast. So everyone's a winner, right? But anyway, back to episode number 127. We've got an artist that was described as the Crown Prince of Pop Art. And that is Lobster Man himself, Philip Colbert. As you'll hear at the first 5 or 10 minutes of this podcast, Philip and I are speaking about Dougie Fields, the artist who was the first I ever wrote to while I was in prison, and rightly so, the first ever guest on this podcast. Now, Philip became good buddies with Patrick on the last few years of Patrick's life, and I'm sure Philip won't mind me saying this, but could it have been possible that they was destined to meet just a few years before Dougie passed away, just to give him enough time to hand over the title of Crown Prince? I'd like to think so. In this episode, you'll hear the rapid rise of Philip Colbert, and how it's only taken him just a few short years to the point where he's had a couple of shows at the Saatchi Gallery and constant sellout shows in the Far East. And if that wasn't enough, he's now taking over the digital world. I mean, he was halfway there a year or so ago when he had a show at the Saatchi Gallery during lockdown that was just attended by robots. But now he's gone fully digital with his show at Lobsteropolis City, which was curated by Simon Dupuy. But anyway, let's hear more about that from the man himself. So please, come and join me over Zoom when I spoke to Philip Colbert. The very first artist was Dougie Fields.
Oh, amazing. That's so cool. He was such a nice guy, Dougie Fields.
He was beautiful, wasn't he?
Talk to him.
Yeah. He was amazing. The very first episode on this. We spoke at near his home in the graveyard there, the Bronson Cemetery.
Yes, you love that graveyard.
Yeah, and that's where we've done it.
Artworks there are of that graveyard. Yeah, I mean, he was such a character, Dougie Fields, and he was such a positive artist in terms of he was always like, you know, he always had time for people of all positions, and he was like very generous, and he didn't have like a toxic ego.
No,
he was a very positive figure, and like his art is even has that vibe. You know, it's like very, you know, very positive, and you know, he was an amazing, you know, an amazing sort of identity as the way, you know, he dressed and his whole interiors and everything. I mean, it was a really cool guy. No, I was quite inspired just to have like, you know, sort of a basic sort of friendship with him when he would come to my shows or like we would meet up. And I always just find him such a positive, amazing guy.
I mean, looking at your work next to each other, you could well have been visual relatives, you know?
Definitely. I think we connected with each other, and I think he saw that in me as well, like this sort of affinity with the primary colors and like the dialogue with pop. And yeah, so I think that we definitely had like there was definitely an art chemistry going on between, and also our influences, like, you know, the things that the artists that he was really inspired by, very similar to the artists that inspired by me, have inspired me. And then, and I think what also I love with him is that he did loads of collaborations, and he was really interested in clothing and the way he presented himself, and art being a bit more than just the painting. He really like pushed out of that into wider sense of things. And yeah, for me though, the ultimate thing with him is just, he just had good energy. You know, I think that's worth a lot. You know, I think sometimes art can, you know, take itself more seriously than humans. Cause I think human beings are what art should celebrate. Not, it shouldn't create egos, which then, you know, then have bad energy to other humans.
Well, Dougie was definitely a walking artwork, wasn't he? What?
When
you speak to Dougie, you enter his world, don't you? And that's what I love. I love an artist who builds a world that they invite other people, the viewer or other artists, into.
Yeah,
you're definitely that yourself.
Well, yeah, I definitely believe in that also, the idea of like, the idea that, you know, an art, when art just basically makes a language and effectively creates like this visual world. And for me, the part of that is the power of art to create a level, like a merger of fantasy and reality. Or you can bring fantasy into reality. Because reality is malleable. It's not like a fixed thing. It's like reality is whatever people choose to see or the way that we choose to believe. And so I think that's why it's so important to constantly break that cage of like, of maybe being too conventional or too black and white. And I think that, that's why even, for example, you know, someone like Dougie, you just look at Dougie and he's got such an amazing, or had such an amazing like persona, that alone would be inspiring to someone just see him walking down the street. You know, so that's a great starting point.
Was you ever able to go into his home?
No, I never visited it in person. It was one of the things that like we constantly talked about, like me going there and stuff, but it just never happened.
It was like walking into a computer program.
No, I can imagine, yeah,
you know, like one of, like the world you've just created yourself.
Yeah.
It was like being immersed in that. You walked through his front door and you was in any of several paintings, you know?
Amazing, yeah. No, I love that about it. I mean, I did some, during lockdown, the first bit of lockdown, I did a few like Zoom chats with him.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, he'd give me tours of his house and stuff. And it was amazing. I mean, I'd seen it already in pictures, but it was so cool.
Well, there was a question that I want to ask you, which is about lockdown, which I'll just put to the side for a sec. If I could just tell you that there's seven questions that I ask each artist. The first being, how would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
Well, I'd like to think that I bring a sort of sense of energy and irony, and I'd like to think like philosophical analysis into contemporary art, but while making it very accessible and I'd like to think like what would I say, emotive to others. Like I'd like to feel that my work is a punk pop, like sort of energy that just to try and inspire others as well. I think like accessibility is really important and just inspiring with creative freedom, you know, like that's the key for me, is this idea of like, you know, the celebration of individual freedom and also the celebration of the individual, and also like, and not getting too caught up in the pompousness of art history. I mean, I love art history, but I think the art world can sometimes become a bit up itself. So I think it's very important to stay, you know, stay real with it.
Yeah, well, you have a lot of art references in your work, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. I'm really interested in art history. I think that, you know, art is a language, and the language of the past informs what art is. And people, you know, are able to enter that discussion and change the possibility of art.
Yeah.
What I have to say.
Did you have art in the home growing up?
Not really at home, but I did. I was really always interested in art. So I always had like more of a photographic memory for things, rather than, I wasn't particularly academic otherwise.
Yeah.
I was very much spaced out as a kid. You know, I wasn't really particularly engaged in school and stuff. So, you know, it was very much like coasting along, sort of on the verge of failing all the time. And actually often failing was actually one of them. I was a bit of a dreamer type kid, a bit disconnected. But the one thing I was always connected with was images, paintings, and the idea of like art. And I think it led in from my interest as a kid almost into the idea of treasures and like the realm of magic and myths, and then how art became like a sort of extension of that, with the legend of the painter, the value of the art, and the window into another world through the frame. And I think those two things just were impactful for me. So I think it was always something I had a reverence for, towards, or an interest, a value to, in, basically. So I guess, yeah, but it took me a long time before I had the confidence to really, you know, like make art in a direct way. I mean, I was working in fashion and clothing and trying to make wearable art, but it took me a long time before I was able to like actually put myself out there as an artist.
Do you know when it was that you decided you wanted to be an artist?
Well, I always wanted to be an artist. Yeah, I always wanted to be an artist, but didn't really think it would be able to be an artist. True, but I guess I didn't really think I'd be able to make a living from being an artist. So it was only really when, I guess when it would have been sort of mid like 2000s, like 2000 or maybe 2008, something like that, that I started really, I guess, pushing myself to do that. And I started making artwork, or making like selling, exhibiting artworks while I was doing clothing design. But it was like, as I said, it was like art clothing. But and then it took a while before my confidence or my feeling to just make that bold step fully into away from, let's say, fashion into art. So it was like a slow transition. And then I guess in like maybe 2016 or 2017, I completely focused on it.
Oh, wow. So it's relatively short period of time then. When did the lobster make his appearance, and why?
The lobster is something that I've had for a while, probably like a symbol associated with which I've been sort of doodling and stuff for a while. And then probably in my clothing design, I would use the symbol of the lobster a lot, because I for me it was like a keyhole icon of surrealism, like a way of hitting out the icon of the protagonist of surrealism, the cartoon lobster. So I would sketch this cartoon lobster, and then that became like a bit of a motif thing that I would wear on suits and stuff, or make chairs or various other objects and vases. And then so people started calling me the Lobster Man because of these lobster symbols I was putting out there. It was probably the most recognizable of the symbols I was using in terms of the one that stuck. And then I already had created this reputation as being the Lobster Man. Not in a massive, like, worldwide known as the Lobster Man, but certainly in a smaller sphere, as I would people call me the Lobster Man. So then it sort of, I in a way then created this label, and I thought, well, that's actually helpful, because it's almost, I've been baptized the Lobster Man already anyway.
Yeah.
So it's quite obvious that I just become, that's just the evolution of my creative language. I just become that and take that journey, to go on a journey with that.
Brilliant. And then before I interrupted you a little while ago, when you mentioned lockdown, during lockdown, I saw a clip on the news when you was at Saatchi Gallery and you'd made the robots going around. And it was a great thing and perfect timing.
Yeah, it was like, I guess the idea came to me because I guess in lockdown, it was such a weird time to do an art show. And so the idea of like, but I didn't want to do nothing because I thought, well, you know, you've got to still try. It's not like I could rest on my laurels as a super artist and just take a year break. I mean, I needed to keep moving forward. Yeah. And so it was like, well, you've got to do something. And so I was thinking,
your brain doesn't stop thinking or creating, does it? You know?
Yeah, I think sometimes also I think it's important to have an attitude where you just make the best of things. And I think, and I just felt like the gallery, the museum and the gallery felt to me at that point like I'm a no-go zone. A bit like oh, we're a shipwreck under the bottom of the ocean. You know, it's like impossible to get to. So I thought it will, you know, a bit like sending diving cameras down into it. I thought, well, actually, it's quite interesting to treat the gallery a bit like there's no go zone, but send robots in. And so, yeah, and then I just thought, actually, you know, it could be really cool to do that. And yeah, funny, it was completely worked in my favor because normally in the opening of my exhibition, you know, like, I'll be lucky if I get like a news crew, very lucky if I get a new. And in this case, there was tons of them at the entrance. And this was during like a few days before a proper lockdown. So it was a total nightmare time to have an exhibition. But it somehow actually worked well for me and my show because the show was designed in a way to work, or it was created for that. So it sort of made it news relevant.
Yeah.
Which is art often is trying, you know, wants to be news relevant, but most people don't really care about what an artist has to say ultimately because it's not necessarily news.
I know what you mean.
And then actually the phenomenon, funny enough, Dougie was one of the first people that I had like as a guest to go around the show. And so I actually met him there as a robot myself. So we were both robots and I gave him a tour of the exhibition and stuff. And it was really cool, just the phenomenon it created just by this telepresence in a physical space, looking at art as robots. And it did have there was a performative part of it, which felt like a piece in itself.
Well, that show was viewed online. And I suppose the next step from a physical show to a sort of semi-digital show brings us to your most recent episode being Lobsteropolis City.
Yeah, so again, this is something that over the lockdown I was feeling like, because I've been working on this digital world it's been for a couple of years really. I've been since the evolution of my lobster character, and it just felt very, and I, you know, part and parcel with the lobster character was also this background of where the lobster lived, and like, and that had been slightly inspired by what I spent some time in Joshua Tree in California, and I really love this outsider place where lots of people would go, and when they didn't have much money, and they would build crazy houses and almost live in a sort of bubble of fantasy where, you know, the regulations are not so strict on housing, so people can build crazy sculpture parks.
I've seen them.
And there was a Noah Purifoy sculpture park, an outsider artist that was an African-American artist and a very, very amazing artist, like one of the great artists, and for my opinion, the 20th century. And he was like an outsider, and he quit the art world and he moved to Joshua Tree and basically built this remarkable sculpture park out of recycled materials you find in the skip.
Yeah.
And it was a triumph of creativity and like, you know, just against the system in a way, just being able to work completely in your imagination using rubbish and to create something epically amazing and beautiful. And so I remember being really affected by that and thinking it's a remarkable thing. So it's always had stuck in my mind as Joshua Tree being this like cool counterculture place. And so then when my lobster was developing, I just connected with that backdrop. So he sort of, and also I love the Salvador Dali desert like reference too. Yeah. So it became a sort of Joshua Tree Dali like backdrop. And then it had this cactus house that I always wanted to build in real in Joshua Tree. So because it was expensive and complicated to build it, then it just became something that the lobster lived in virtually.
Yeah, yeah.
And the rest then just evolved after, you know, from that. And then so I'd had this digital world, and then it felt in the lockdown that I should really be taking this, putting it on a platform so that people could be interacting with it.
Yeah.
And then with the birth of the real growth and development of the digital art movement with the NFTs and things, and then Decentraland really evolved at a crazy speed. It just felt actually it would be a good opportunity to put it online and put it on Decentraland, which, yeah, is a really interesting platform.
Yeah.
And I worked with these guys at Vega City, who are the biggest like land holding group in Decentraland, and they amazingly were game for doing this like project, and they've been really supportive with it. So and the idea was really that it would be the single biggest, you know, single artist project on Decentraland, because it is like creating a whole world in a world.
But for those that don't know, could you just clarify what Decentraland is? And also, you mentioned about NFTs. Could you just describe NFTs?
Yeah, so Decentraland is like a metaverse platform, other world platform, where, you know, people have avatars and they go into this virtual world and they can interact, they can buy things, they can view digital art, have conversations with people. So they have, it's like a proper world, digital world. And the property prices have become very expensive, and you know, it's developing a whole ecosystem. So it's become its own world in a real way, which is crazy. And it's evolving very fast. You know, like lots of brands are doing things there, and lots of artists are doing things there. So it's a community that's growing very quickly. So that's Decentraland. And I think that's very interesting. In the future of Decentraland is very interesting, in terms of it's growing very quickly. So, you know, it's quite bonkers to think what could be possible there. Then the NFT is obviously this non-fungible token, this way of making digital art synchronized to the Ethereum blockchain. And it's become a new way that people can appreciate a video art, and it's created a market for digital art in a way that never really existed before.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's given, I guess, finally sort of crowned the significance of digital art by giving it this platform. And in fact, there's no question that digital art is the art of our time, in terms of it's the medium of our time. So there's a few things have aligned basically to make this movement particularly interesting conceptually.
I mean, it's the digital world is one of those that is advancing at a rapid rate. And people that aren't involved in that world, they find it hard to keep up with the rate that it's moving, you know? Because you're even inviting people to make their own avatars, aren't you, as well?
Yeah, well, that's the Decentraland thing. People choose their avatars, so they, like, create a persona. And then even the craze where people, you know, can buy wearables and stuff like clothing for their avatar, and they're very expensive, often, these wearables. So it's really its own ecosystem. You know, it has tons of businesses now working in there.
And you've got Simon Dupuy.
Yeah, so he's someone that is obviously quite an established art world figure, and knows a lot about art, and is a really interesting character. And he's someone that I guess I've collaborated with a few times over the year. So he's always quite open-minded about things, and he's quite interesting. You know, he's quite a risk taker in a way. He's not someone that just hides behind their brand and reputation and plays safe. He's a very creative guy. So he's always up for ideas. And hence he was very sweet to also get involved in my robot project. And he did some tours and interviews and stuff as a robot around the exhibition. And I just thought it'd be really cool to bring in a few personas into my space and get them to interact with the whole thing. So I also worked with the band Devo, which were a legendary new wave band in America. For me, one of the most important art bands, you know, concept bands, really pop bands that there are, up there with the Pill and the Sex Pistols and stuff, in my opinion.
Brilliant. And the viewer, how can they see Lobsteropolis City?
So they go basically they log on to Decentraland, and then they find Vega City, which is the district.
Yeah.
So Lobsterland is in, or Lobsteropolis is in Vega City, and you can't really miss it when you're in Vega City, because it's a massive development. And then they just go in and there's tons of stuff to see.
Brilliant.
In there.
It's really quite exciting, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, for me, what's interesting about it, it feels like profound in one way and then meaningless in another. It's like, and I think there's always this thing where, when you're trying to do something slightly different and a bit new, let's say you're trying to create, like for me, what's new about this is the phenomenon of the articulation of, let's say, I believe in the art world. So literally having my art world and then allowing people to interact with it, like a really interactive sculpture in a way, but the whole art world is interactive.
Yeah.
Is allowing someone to walk into a Dalí painting and interact with him, and interact with him, interact with the language in the painting. So I see it as like a profound development in the possibility for art and language, art language, yet very accessible, which is cool. It's a bit like a theme park, like a like a Disneyland theme park. So it's got that history of, like, obviously Banksy doing Dismal Land, you know, is an interesting example of that also. So for me, it's like a metaverse, you know, theme park art world where it's very accessible, yet also trying to do something exceptionally groundbreaking in my attempt, I got my belief.
But, yeah, yeah.
And so I guess the win is that we create, there's a phenomenon in the interactivity and all these different elements at play that create a new vibe of something that's been created. You know what I mean?
It definitely feels like a part of the art world that is about to blossom. It's on the brink of erupting, even, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's, certainly on a conceptual level, I think it's, you know, because the NFT rise is amazing, but the next step for that is like the digital context to the piece. It's like the digital gallery, the digital world, you know? And so I think that's for me what I think is, it just allows for this, the reinvention of experience.
Because you've created several NFTs yourself, haven't you?
I've worked with this platform, Super Rare, and I've done some with them, and we're going to have some more through the gallery, the museum in the space.
Brilliant.
So I think, again, for me, that felt a lot more interesting than just making NFTs. I felt that, you know, the NFTs were cool, but I liked the idea of having it set within the world, because I just thought that was like taking...
Gives them a bit of visuality as well, doesn't it? You know, a bit of substance where you can actually go and view them in
exactly picture. It's the bigger picture,
ironically. If there was you and five other artists, Philip, past and present, what do you reckon your ideal group show would be?
I think, I mean, I love, like, artists. I love the Chirico, you know, Giorgio de Chirico. Nice. I love Calder, you know, obviously, what other artists, I mean, ones that I'd say I really connect with artistically, Leger. I love Fernand Leger. I think he's an amazing, amazing painter. Who else do I really like? I mean, I don't know, is that five probably already? I love them. I love Arp, Jean Arp. I love Dubuffet. I like Nikki St. Fowl.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And if you wasn't an artist, what do you reckon you'd like to be?
Ooh, I mean, I think in a way, you know, some people can make art out of anything. You know, like, you can sell ice cream in an ice cream van and become an artist somehow. I think for me, I guess luckily being an artist allows me to be very excited about what I'm doing, and like, I think it's a very lucky privilege to be an artist, because a lot of people are supporting society in a way, like, and art is a way, a bit of the free froth of society to some extent. So it's a very luxury to be an artist ultimately. But I think, you know, I guess just having loving what you do is an amazing privilege, to love what you do. I mean, and I always get inspired when I meet people that just take great pride and passion in what they do. It could be like someone that operates horse tours at a pleasure beach, or it could be someone that a fisherman, or it could be, you know, anything. I think just because there's poetry in everything and there's meaning in everything.
Yeah, totally.
And that's why I'm always like inspired by people that basically just really appreciate things, like, because I think you know, yes, there's all this materialism and layers to culture and society and dynamics of what people achieve in their lives and stuff, but ultimately it's no more meaningful than, you know, just looking at the stars at night. So I think, you know, just, I think just being lucky enough to just really love what you do is the key, I think, somehow.
Oh, beautiful.
Sort of answer the question is a bit vague, but
no, I think it's beautiful. It answers it perfectly. Yeah. So other than Lobsteropolis City, what else is on the horizon?
So I've got another show coming up in a museum in Korea. So I'm just working on that in Busan. And then,
people in Korea love the pop art, don't they?
Yeah, well, Korea is very enthusiastic for art in general. It's got amazing, there's amazing energy for art there, and people are super friendly, you know, open-minded and very enthusiastic. So it's a really interesting place to show art, I found. And then also Taipei is an amazing city I really like, and I've got another show there in October. So yeah, I think so. And I've got a museum show that just opened in Quanxing in China. So I think it's great, that sort of, and then I've got another cool art music project. It's not quite agreed, but if it happens, that would be really cool. I mean, I've been working on the idea of it, but it's not fully finalized.
Where can people see what you're doing, Philip, be it online or social media?
Yeah, so I think on my website, generally I keep like a pretty track of shows, like maybe not the ones that are currently on, but certainly the ones that have been before. On Instagram, I generally try and keep my work on there. And then obviously, hopefully now in Lobsteropolis City, I'm hoping to just keep pushing that forward and like using that as a real showcase for my world, really.
And I presume that city can be an ongoing thing. It has no date constraints.
It's an ongoing thing. So I think it's just what would I say? It's like it's a work in progress. So I think we'll see. Like, you know, I mean, obviously, I want to keep building it, and like I believe it's an interesting concept, sort of conceptual project for me. But it's hard to know, obviously, like where it will go. It's very much the start of
it. Well, it's as soon as you open it, it's sort of no longer in your control then, is it, really?
Exactly. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Nice. Well, Philip, I think that's all my questions asked.
Amazing. Well, great questions. Yeah.
Anything else to add, do you think?
No, I think you covered pretty much everything.
I was in the Fulham show with Charlotte.
Oh, amazing. That's so cool. I went to that show when Charlotte was setting it up. It looked amazing.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool, doesn't it? I mean, her work, I don't know if you know, but it stayed in that room on its own pretty much.
Yeah.
There was a couple of paintings, well, depending on which way you come to it, there was a couple of paintings on the far wall in that room, and that was about it. And it did look quite ghostly and on
yeah,
its
amazing
own.
Setting.
And it
amazing
was setting. It was a pretty cool building. I was down in the cellar. I had a room down. I was amongst the street artists.
Yeah.
No, it was a great show. It's coming down. It's coming down this week.
That's a pity, because it's an amazing exhibition. Yeah, it looks so cool. I mean, I love just that backdrop for an arts show is just amazing. I mean, I love derelict spaces. They're just so romantic looking.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And there's a few, since it's been on, there's a few people have sort of like hired the place out to go and use it as a backdrop, you know, for whatever. Yeah, yeah,
so
good.
Cool.
Okay, mate. Well, thank you very much for your time.
You so much.
I really do appreciate it.
Such a great, inspiring story of how art can be positive impact on the world.
There you go. Philip Colbert. How cool was he? I've been looking forward to speaking to Philip for quite some time. So thank you to KTW London for setting up that connection for me. So, Lobsteropolis City, his first fully digital exhibition. In a virtual gallery, in a virtual world. Is it going to be the way forward? Who knows? But if it is, Philip Colbert's beat most of us to it, that's for sure. And having Simon Dupuy curate your show is pretty cool as well, right? Maybe that's another one we should look at trying to get on the Ministry of Arts podcast. So that's about it. We've got another episode out Thursday. That's going to be artist and curator Amy Jackson. And you'll hear that Amy is curating the alternative art trail for the Kensington and Chelsea Art Week. And that art week, which has now been extended, becomes the Kensington and Chelsea Art Festival. And that runs on until the end of August. So you've got plenty of time to see the work on show. And that's this Thursday. So, I'll see you then. Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're unable to support us on Patreon, leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to this podcast really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast, or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Anything is appreciated, but either way, thanks for listening, and until next week, ta-da.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My name is Mary Loy, and I'm a welding major and a Marine. I chose Columbus State. Columbus State was an affordable way for me to try out different fields and find a career that I was excited about. 1 week into my first welding class, I fell in love with welding. It's in every building, every bridge, and every roadway that you drive on. I chose Columbus State. Now, I've found my niche in an industry that's shaping the skyline of Columbus.